Bill. Welcome to Take One. This is a pleasure to have you here. I'm Ben Borthwick, the curator of the installation here at Tate Modern. Harmonic Bridge has been commissioned by Platform for Art and is a simultaneous installation at Southwark Underground Station and in the west end of the Turbine Hall at Tate Modern. So, Bill, it's obviously an honour that you've been able to do this, both for us and I hope for you as well.
Yes.
We've been working on this for, I think it was about 18 months ago that we first met on the bridge and you played me some of the recordings that you made. Can you just sketch out how this project came about?
Well, it came about because several years ago I was coming to London for different projects, and every time I came to London I would spend some time on the Millennium Bridge with a portable recorder and some accelerometers and make test recordings of the bridge and started to investigate the possibility of making an acoustic artwork out of the sounds of the bridge. And every time I made a recording, it became more and more sort of convincing and interesting to me what that artwork could be. And it became very clear to me at an early stage that this Turbine Hall in the Tate Modern was one of the locations that I would like to have the work placed.
And why in the Turbine Hall?
Well, because I felt like the sort of nature of the sounds that are coming off the bridge with these very harmonic sort of drones and oscillations it makes in the wind, and the kind of industrial resonant metallic quality of its sound really fit well within the architectural context of this space, which is this real sort of an industrial sort of feeling to it. And I felt like with the resonance of the space, the sounds would be quite musical in here. And then about 9 months ago, Arup Acoustics did a simulation with some of my test recordings of the bridge in an acoustic model they had made at the Turbine Hall. So I got to hear actually what this work may possibly have sounded like, you know, in the space.
Yeah, that's a very interesting, it's a fascinating experience to go along to the Arup Sound Lab. And just a bit of background, the Sound Lab is a department of Arup which is used to create simulations of architectural spaces from the architectural plans. So what they have a kind of front end and a back end. The front end is where they've documented existing spaces such as concert halls. The back end is creating the sound of places that haven't yet been built. So how the materials and how the shapes of the interior of a concert hall, for example, will sound. Now, so they came and mapped the Turbine Hall because of the drone of the transformers, because Tate One remains right next to a substation. So the drone of the transformers has been mapped by Arup, and then they took your recordings and processed it to give an exact simulation of how the sounds would be experienced within the space, because they're very different when you listen to them on the headphones than they are actually here within the Turbine Hall itself.
I think the interaction of the sounds with the Turbine Hall makes the sounds more musical. It really enhances the sounds.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And there's, I mean, not only this dialogue, this conversation between the tonality of the Turbine Hall, and you can hear in the background the sounds of the bridge, but I think also the relationship it makes between these different structures, and that goes for Southwark as well, actually, where the atrium in which the work is installed has a very particular sonority, the shape, this kind of semi-dome shape with glass panels means that there's a very particular resonance. And all three of these projects were new builds for the Millennium. Tape 1 was obviously a conversion, but the whole structure was stripped out. And I think that's a fascinating, as well as the acoustic element, I think there's a fascinating social marker that this project makes. Identifying three completely new landmarks within the social geography of London. I'm thinking about the musicality of the sounds within the space. When we were listening to them on the headphones, you know, for the last 18 months, there were certain sounds that were beguiling, and you know, it seemed to be, you know, very ethereal and almost inexplicable, yet at a certain level they always seem to refer back to being off the bridge. Now that we're in the Turbine Hall, playing it through this amazing system that's been installed in here, the level of detail has pulled out a musicality which I don't think any of us heard beforehand. Can you talk a little bit about how you've mixed the piece down and how you've tuned both the bridge and the space?
Well, in creating a physical network of listening devices, accelerometers on the bridge, a large amount of research and discussion was had with Arup, who had built the bridge, and we worked out eight really ideal listening points on which to place accelerometers. Four of these are on the large support cables, called tension cables, that actually support the structure of the bridge, and four of them were on the smaller balustrade cables. And with in the acoustic worlds of these two types of cables are a wide range of sounds. The tension cables each have a slightly different fundamental resonance, which you can hear almost like a continuous drone in the Turbine Hall. You will hear sounds of footsteps, luggage carts, bicycles, runners, all those kinds of impact sounds along the deck of the bridge are picked up by these cables. When the bridge becomes very excited with either a lot of people on it or if it starts to get windy, the balustrade cables start to produce this very kind of rapid pulsating sound, kind of high-pitched sound that gets transferred to the balustrade, to the tension cables, as this this strange almost, they sound almost like steel marbles rolling on some kind of a glass surface to me. And it's somehow the journey of the balustrade cables vibrating very strongly on their part of the bridge, kind of echoing through the whole structure of the Millennium Bridge. And when those sounds are played in the Turbine Hall, they generate flutter echoes, which are very beautiful.
So what you're talking about is the way in which sounds that come through directly from the sensors on the balustrade cables as one set of sounds are then received, and the vibrations are carried through the balustrade posts down into the structure and are received by the suspension cables as a different sound.
As a different sound, yes.
So like on a fairly windy day, the balustrade cable was making kind of brang, like a, and that, quite and a metallic sound, and, like a strumming.
And part of that sound gets picked up by the main suspension cables, and it's filtered by the whole structure of the bridge, but what's left of it is this amazing kind of high-pitched sound that I never really recognized before when I was doing the test recordings.
And to me they sound like strumming an electric bass guitar that's not plugged in. You know, it has this sort of very metallic, sort of slightly, well, I mean, you know, a bass guitar is metal, it's metal, it's wires, you know, wire strings, and just them vibrating without any sort of receiver to process their sound. And then when it's received, when it's interpreted by the suspension cable, it sounds like a kind of high-pitched woodblock or a triangle, kind of ping. Now, but there's another sound which the balustrade cables make, which is quite extraordinary. In very windy conditions.
Right, it starts to oscillate and make this droning sound.
And so that oscillation happens because the wires, instead of banging from side to side of the hole in the post that keeps them in place, am I right in understanding that they actually spin around the edge of the hole, therefore creating a smooth vibration?
Right, that's right. That's right.
And that has almost like a sound like a theremin, a kind of intensely melodic set of tones. And so depending on the mix, because you have four channels on each set of cables, four on the suspension cables, four on the balustrade cables, but you don't have all eight channels being played back in the turbine hall. You've created a series of mixes or cues that distribute the sound in different ways. Can you talk about the distribution both of channels and within the space?
Well, in mixing it for the turbine hall, I never play all of the eight input channels at one time. I play different combinations of them, and I've arranged a series of about two dozen short spatial compositions that work with as few as two inputs from the bridge, and as many as six at one time. And the sounds enter softly and quietly into the space. They start to slowly change their positions and move around in the space, explore the acoustics of the space, and then slowly disappear and become silent, and always returning to the hum of the turbine hall and the kind of ambient sound of the space as we just have now. And this, so the work is always breathing and coming in as a gesture, leaving the space untouched for a little while, and then coming back a little differently. So, and because the sounds are live, and the personality of the bridge is affected by the number of people on it, the weather conditions, it's always something different to hear. It's never quite the same.
So it's not possible to kind of recognize where in the cycle you are. So even though it's a loop, it's not actually something that you can kind of listen to from start to finish.
I can tell when I hear it, maybe some of the inputs that are playing, but I don't, from hearing it, I don't know exactly where it is in the cycle.
And so. And so what you end up with is a patchwork of playbacks, which sometimes are very quiet, with just occasional sort of percussive hits, and some distant footsteps resonating as a kind of almost like a pulsating drone. But then at other times you have much more kind of foreground, sort of powerful.
Yeah, yesterday morning when I came here, the bridge was extremely quiet. And today it's very active.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other day when it was raining, yesterday when it was raining, during the day, the sound is amazing in the rain.
How does that sound?
Well, you could hear the raindrops hitting the cables.
Oh, really? Right, it's been so dry that during none of the tests did it rain remarkably, but then also since the installation, we haven't really had a rain day. Yesterday
it was beautiful. It was just beautiful to hear it in the rain.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to more rain then.
Rain and wind.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There aren't many times that we'd wish for it. But now, just the other day, we went upstairs to have a coffee in the members' room on level 6, which looks out over the bridge and the river and St. Paul's. And something that struck me was the shadow that's cast by the bridge onto the water. Now, this struck me for two reasons. First of all, you mention shadows when you talk about the sounds how the bridges are relayed.
Well, the large suspension cables actually will pick up what I would describe as the shadows of acoustic sounds. They'll hear part of the frequency spectrum of ships passing under the bridge. They can even hear the squeals of train wheels on the Blackfriars Bridge, or a couple of times I've heard seagulls. I once heard a bagpiper. So they'll pick up, they're really like acoustic shadows, because they don't hear the full range of the acoustic sound, just a part of it that happens to fit within the frequency spectrum of a large steel cable.
Yeah, so most of the sounds have been processed to fit within a frequency range, almost as if they've been compressed.
Right.
Like the footsteps or like the effect of the wind on the cables. But this idea of this fact, I've listened to it, of the bagpiper, the sound of the pipes carrying through, is quite amazing. I mean, love them or hate them, I think everyone recognises that bagpipes, the sound of pipes carries for a huge distance. And can you explain the sort of physics behind that a little bit?
Well, in order for an accelerometer to, a steel cable to pick up an acoustic sound, there just has to be a correspondence between the frequencies of the acoustic sound and the harmonics of the material. That it just happens that the acoustic frequencies of the acoustic sound can find a sympathetic vibration in the material that makes it vibrate. The balustrade cables don't have enough physical mass to them to be excited by an external source, and they're constantly in motion. Whereas the suspension cables are much more under much more tension, and because they have a larger physical surface, they have more of an ability to maybe be influenced by something.
So within these recordings that you've made, it's almost as if the sound of the piper is like a kind of an acoustic version of a geological fossil.
Yes.
It's like it will be there forever in posterity.
Yes.
And future generations will wonder what the hell is that sound.
Right. It is like a fossil. It is kind of a fossil.
Yeah, okay.
But it's also like the other feeling I get when I listen with accelerometers on the bridge, especially when I was doing the test recordings. I was reading all of these Brian Greene books about string theory and multidimensional universes, and because when you stand on the bridge, none of the sounds that the accelerometer picks up are audible to your ears. I really felt like the sound inside the metal was like another dimension of reality, dimension of the universe.
I mean, but what's extraordinary is that in these very few instances of a true sound being transmitted by the cables is what comes through. and it is the pipes and the screech of the wheels.
Well, it's funny, and according to these physicists like Brian Greene, the only sort of force in the universe that is capable of being common to all the 11 dimensions of the universe is gravity.
Yeah.
It's the only common sort of force between all the dimensions of an 11 dimensional universe. And it's kind of like these acoustic shadows kind of make me think of that a little bit.
When we were up in the cafe looking down onto the bridge, the sun cast a shadow at a certain angle that made it look as if that made it resemble the strings riding down the neck of a violin or a cello onto the raised wooden element, which is known as the bridge, on those instruments, before being tied down to the structure itself. And so the tuning element or tuning metaphor that you've talked about really came through that visual image for me. And since then I started to notice these other visual images of musicality in some of the kind of background materials that you've gathered together. For example, in the poster for the project, it shows a shot looking down the suspension cables with Tate Modern in the background, and it's as if the posts that hold the suspension cables in place are hammers on hitting piano strings. Like I said, there's the violin or cello example from the shadow. Like, how much do you look for these sort of recognizable elements within the world of music when you do a project, or are those just absolutely by chance?
I think it's by coincidence in this case. I think I was really kind of looking or seeking the sound, and it was just a happy coincidence.
I mean, I guess thinking back through your other projects, you've done some work about the Golden Gate Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge, both of which, having got this set of visual references for the Millennium Bridge now, I look at them and I see harps and lyres and other things like this. But I guess that because the Millennium Bridge is a footbridge, it's a suspension bridge, but it's a footbridge, it's probably much more musical than either of those two would be in its range, just because it doesn't have to bear the same kind of weight.
It's more interesting, it's more elastic structure. Golden Gate Bridge is very stiff by comparison. The Brooklyn Bridge, when I worked on it, was interesting because it had a steel grid roadway that made these beautiful oscillating sounds.
But that was less about the cables than the surface.
It was about the road surface of the bridge. Yeah.
Okay.
And the cables on the Golden Gate Bridge produce a very little sound compared to the Millennium Bridge.
That's probably, I don't know, but I imagine that while they look quite diaphanous in the way that the Millennium Bridge does, when you're up close, they're probably the size of our bodies. The width of the cables are probably...
Also, they're designed to vibrate much less.
Yeah.
Because in a structure that's bearing that much weight, you don't really want them to vibrate that much.
One of the moments when the weightlessness, the sort of almost transparent floating visual effect of the bridge became most apparent to me was when I realized, when you realized that what we initially thought was some kind of radio interference with the signal, these short bursts of static that slowly rose in a crescendo and then decayed away, was actually the vibrations of a propeller from a boat passing under right. the bridge. And even that kind of minute vibration being sent up through the concrete tower stanchions of the bridge and being absorbed as some sort of stimulus onto the suspension cables. I mean, that's a remarkable remarkable addition to the range of sounds that comes through. Many of your projects have been based in the public realm, in public spaces. I know that you've done projects within museum spaces before, so you have a permanent installation at the Leeds City Art Gallery, for instance, and then at some SF MoMA in San Francisco. You've also done projects within the building. But the Turbine Hall is a fairly unique space, both in terms of its scale as well as its sonority. Can you talk a little bit about what it is to do, to work in these different kinds of environments?
Well, I suppose the Turbine Hall at the Tate Modern is the most extraordinary museum space I'd ever worked in because of its scale and because of its acoustics. And because of those two factors, I think it lends itself very well to this type of sound art project. But the fact that the sound that's coming into here is always changing, it's always a real connection to the bridge. None of the moments of sound that happen here will ever be repeated exactly.
Yeah.
Fascinates me.
And that relationship to a kind of open structure has, it runs all the way back through your work over the decades, back to when you were initially trained as a music student. Is that right? Was there a formative moment that sort of opened up the possibilities of working in this way?
Well, I think when I was a student in the late 60s in New York, I received a lot of encouragement from John Cage and some people around John Cage, that the kind of very modest experiments with sound, making sound collages out of real sound, that was a path I should pursue. But I think a big turning point for me was the opportunity to live and work in Australia in the early 1970s, when I was hired by the Australian Broadcasting Company to document what Australia sounded like.
And it gave me gargantuan project.
Yes, it gave me access for several years to the state of the art in recording technology, and sort of on what seemed like all the time in the world to go anywhere I wanted in this vast country to record sounds and to think about what it meant. And the first works that I really called sound sculptures were created in this period in my life, because I had access to mobile 8-channel recording systems that were in an outside broadcast truck. And I can remember on a warm summer night in 1976, taking this truck to a place in the northern part of Sydney Harbour called Kirribilli, and placing 8 ribbon microphones over the openings of 8 minute cylindrical blowholes on a floating concrete pier, and getting the amazing rhythmic patterns of the waves passing under this pier in the form of 8 changing compression waves in the blowholes. So that work, Kirribilli Wharf, was done in 1976, and that's 30 years ago. And I really, in many respects, regard that as kind of opus one.
Yeah. do you still think in terms of, you know, how important is your training in composition to the way that you work now?
Well, it's influenced me a lot because it's given me a musician's ear when I listen to the world. And it's given me a composer's mind when I think about structuring the works and mixing them and tuning them to the space.
So we've just been talking about the more kind of contingent Cajun works that you've done, but recent examples or, you know, recent pieces that you've made, such as the commission for the St. Martin's Bell Tower in Birmingham, and then again another bell piece, Speeds of Time, which was based on Big Ben in the Palace of Westminster. Those have a very different kind of compositional approach, which is much more kind of grid-like and mathematical. Well,
right, and those works really brought me back to probably some of my earlier days as a as a composer.
So pre-Opus One, Billy Wolf.
It was that side of my work that I normally don't have an opportunity to use, sort of fit those situations.
When you say that side of my work,
the real composer side.
And is that something that, so are those two pieces almost exclusive to your recent work, or are there other works back through the years that same composition?
I mean, occasionally I did a work for the University Art Museum in Berkeley, UC Berkeley, or on the campus of UC Berkeley. There's a carillon, which is a Dutch style for ringing bells, where the bells are stationary and the clappers of the bells move, and it's played kind of keyboard. And the project there involved actually writing some minimal music for the carillon that was picked up by microphones in the rooftops of buildings on the Berkeley campus and transmitted to a sound system installed on the facade of the museum, which was also in the sound field with the bells, so that the natural acoustic delays of the bells traveling through the campus interacted with the minimal composition I'd created. It kind of became the missing piece of the composition. It was sort of like, if you think of, if you go to music stores and you'll see music minus one, where if you're learning a concerto, maybe you'll hear the piano accompaniment, but you have to play the instrument with it. I sort of saw that as kind of like, it was more like music minus eight, because it was eight channels. And in doing that, the person playing the bells could wear headphones and hear a stereo mix of the sounds traveling through the campus. So you could interact with that.
And so if it was the one carillon player, then it was music minus one, yours became the composition, while the carillon player becomes the accompanist.
Right, and he had an improvise with his interaction with what he heard from the acoustic delays, so that he could play with the acoustic delays of the bells within certain parameters. That I did that. I early on, around the time of Kirby Wharf, I had gotten involved with a couple of music schools in Australia, and wrote a work for four pianos. It's called Music Sculpture for Four Pianos. I wrote a work for six marimbas. I wrote a work for it was a sound sculpture for a brass band. Kind of a la, inspired a little bit by Charles Ives, I suppose, thinking of a brass band spread out for a large distance in a landscape and the sound sort of echoing. So I had those things in my past, and I suppose if circumstances ever came about in the future where I could sort of bring back those sides of my creative self, I probably would find them again.
Oh, it's interesting to hear about the brass piece, because until now I was thinking sort of bells as percussion and strings as the...
But also, I used to, the main instrument that I used to play was the clarinet. And actually, I had fantasies when I was working here in the turbine hall of coming here in the middle of the night with a clarinet when nobody was around and just playing it.
Well, I hope that at some point in the archives, someone will dig up a secret recording of the of your midnight foray into the turbine.
Yeah, it was one of my fantasies about it, so working here. But I had written a piece of minimal music, ultra minimal music, for two clarinets. It was called Phantom Clarinets, and it's for two clarinets that breathe together, and a clarinet is capable of producing subaudible sine tones, which are really the threshold of audibility. So two clarinets play subaudible sine tones that are very slightly out of tune with each other, so that the different sounds, the beat frequencies, are louder than the individual sounds of the instrument. And it creates the illusion that the clarinets aren't making a sound. You see them breathing together, and you get this disembodied, spatially disembodied, subsonic vibration.
Wow.
And it modulates then any ambient noise in the room. So this was this was something that was even pre-Kirbally Wharf. I mean, I was doing this in New York before I went to Australia. This was
sounds very of that moment with kind of Alvin Lucier.
This
and
was
other people.
Early 1970s
work. That sounds fantastic. Well, Bill,
Phantom Clarinets.
Thank you very much.